The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning is meant to be a continuation of last Sunday morning's talk. And what I said I'd do today is to give a little bit, kind of an overview or a little bit brief introduction to the topic of last week, which was the Eightfold Path, and then have some discussion, take questions and see what's on your mind around this topic. So as an introduction to it, I'd like to read the opening two paragraphs from Wendy Johnson's brand new book called Gardening at the Dragon's Gate. Wendy Johnson was a practitioner at the San Francisco Zen Center for some 30 years, kind of the master gardener there, and she's taught here for us in the past. So she writes, the chapter is titled Into the Tangle. And what you don't know is that, probably some of you, is that there's a very famous poem by one of the most famous teachers of all the history of Theravada Buddhism named Buddha Ghosha. Or he quotes this poem. It maybe goes back to the Buddha even. And the English translation goes something like, tangled in the tangle. This whole generation is tangled in the tangle. Who is it that it can untangle the tangle? Something like that. So she knows this poem. So she titles it Into the Tangle. When I was a brand new gardener, I planted my first bed of sweet corn at Tassajara Zen Monastery Center. I was working by myself in the upper garden, wrapped with concentration. I stretched a string line the full length of the 65-foot row where I was planting the corn. And just under this line, I scratched out a 3-inch deep furrow. The string showed me where to plant and kept me straight. I filled my fist with dry, shriveled kernels of bantam sweet corn. And every 2 inches or so, I dropped a kernel of corn into the furrow. I wasn't sure that I would have enough seed, so I left the furrow uncovered until the entire line was planted. I was working on my hands and knees, head down, and deep under the spell of the ancient ritual of planting seed. I imagined green blades of corn rising out of the black skirt of the ground. Finally, the line was sown, and I looked up from my supplicant's crouch. A rotund Steller's Jay was at the bottom of my corn furrow, hopping fearlessly down the line, gobbling up each of my carefully sown kernels. Gobbling up each of my carefully sown kernels of sweet corn. The bold bird paused for a moment, fixed me with her bright eye, and continued to feast. And my life as a gardener cracked open and took root. What I realized that summer day was fundamental. Gardening is about awareness and relationship, consequential relationship. It's also about taking a stand and standing by your principles. At the same time, it's about giving up control and learning from your mistakes. This hasn't been an easy lesson for me. When I recovered from my stunned shock in the Tassajara corn furrow, I leapt to my feet, bellowing war cries at the retreating backside of the fat corn-fed jay. Muttering under my breath, I distributed the remaining corn seed in the row and stamped closed the furrow. Today, 30-odd years later, I'm still pursuing blue jays, and they are still pursuing me. So it's her essays about gardening. And with this idea of, she's learned awareness, you have to pay attention. And you also pay attention to what she calls relationships, consequential relationships. And the Eightfold Path has to do with both. It has to do with awareness, paying attention. And it has to do paying attention to your life, to yourself, and to the world around you. Because those are the relationship you have to what you do and yourself and your thoughts, your feelings, the world, your friends, everyone. Those relationships are consequential. And how you behave in them is consequential. And part of the Eightfold Path, or part of the teachings of the Buddha, was to pay attention to consequence and start taking some responsibility for it, or take some sense of how to navigate through this consequential world we live in. And then for Wendy's, part of it is giving up control. But a gardener can't only give up control. And there's a wonderful combination of trying to be in control, trying to do your best, try to work with the conditions you have, and you have to give up control, a certain degree of control, to let something grow. You can't force the corn to grow. You can nourish it to grow, support it to grow. You can't tug at it. That doesn't help, to tug it to grow faster. And so awareness and a sense of consequential relationship. When the Buddha talked about the Eightfold Path, one of the very important words that he used, we're talking about practice in general, but also the Eightfold Path, and also ethics, behavior, was a word that's translated into a word in Pali, kusala, which is sometimes translated into English as skill, skillfulness. So rather than using criteria of good and bad, right and wrong, he used this idea of, is it skillful, is it helpful? Is it healthy? The word kusala also has a meaning of mental health as well. Is it healthy to do it? And so to look at our life and what is it that's helpful, what's healthy, what is skillful, what's useful to do. And so the Eightfold Path is one of the ways the Buddha presented a skillful life, a helpful life, a healthy one that produces mental health. It's good for us and for others. And so he offered these eight different steps. And most people know about the eight steps, but he also offered what's called a tenfold path. And very few people realize that he actually also taught a tenfold path. So we'll go review them. So the first eight are right view, right orientation. You have to get to have it, or you be oriented to know where you're going to go. So you have to have the right orientation. Then the right intention or the right attitude by which you're going to go, you approach this. Then the right speech, how you speak, how you are. I take that as shorthand for how you're in relationship to other people. So, because that's a lot of relationship happens through the medium of speech. So we pay attention to our relationships, right? Consequential relationships, consequential speech. And then there's paying attention to our action, which is also ethical, has to do with relationships, how we behave in relationship to others in the world. And then there's right livelihood. Then there's right, what's called right effort, making the effort that's helpful, avoiding the effort that's harmful. Then right mindfulness and right concentration. So these are the important eightfold steps. And before I tell you the last two, I'd like to suggest to you that one of the fundamental principles that underlie these eight is the practice of awareness and the practice of paying attention to the consequence of your behavior as you're aware of what's going on. And awareness, you know, is a little bit vague word, what that means. And on one hand, it means mindfulness. Mindfulness sometimes seems like a narrowing of awareness because it's a clear recognition of what's going on within the field of awareness. But a term that I like that's even broader than awareness is presence. And so the one of the includes awareness, but I like the word presence because awareness can suggest for some people kind of a mental awareness, mentally aware. And presence is something you inhabit, you live, you're in your body. You're present with your whole being, hopefully, not just with your thoughts, your ideas, your mind. And so presence is also some sense of inner fullness or vitality, completeness, a feeling of really being here in a way that hopefully is deeply satisfying. To be fully, have this sense of presence, and to settle into presence. And out of that comes greater awareness. So the Eightfold Path have as the kind of the thread, the common denominator through all of them, is a degree of presence. And in fact, I believe that a lot of these eight aspects, are almost natural consequences for most people, naturally arise for people if their presence is strong, if they develop their presence. I think that if you cultivate strong presence, and you're really present for your experience in your life, and presence meaning you're open for the fullness of it, not just what you, the blinders on, you wear in a particular way. you will, sooner or later, become aware of the first fold, which is you're aware of suffering. And if you're really present, if sooner or later you become aware of the causes of suffering and the possibility of letting go, you'll see the joys of your life fully, hopefully, and you'll see the struggles of your life, the difficulties. And for some people, that's quite hard because some people will easily avoid, run away, escape from their difficulties, their suffering. And Buddhism is a very adult practice because you're expected to be present for it, to stay present, not run away. And we're not looking for trouble when we do Buddhist practice. We're not using our presence to look for... But if we're present, you know, sooner or later, a few of us will suffer. And when that happens, if you're committed to being present, you'll be present for it. You'll enter it with presence. You'll be more sensitive to it. It becomes more richer, alive for you, that whole world. As you stay more present for your experience, have greater presence, I think sooner or later you'll become pretty aware of your attitude that you have in relation to what's going on. The attitude stands out. If you're belligerent, it'll stand out. Oh, this doesn't feel good. If you're kind, that'll feel better. Or it'll occur to you that as you're more present, there'll be greater sense of empathy as well for yourself and for the world around you. And it'll be natural to change your attitude and have an attitude that's more kind and more compassionate. No one has to tell you to be compassionate and kind. It just will grow naturally out of that commitment to being present. And the same thing, because of that empathy and that sensitivity, next three folds of the Eightfold Path unfold themselves. So we have right speech, right action, and right livelihood. As you're more present and sensitive, I think that we tend to adjust our speech to be more harmonious, more helpful to people and ourselves, more generous, and same with our actions and our livelihood. And then the sixth one is right effort. It's very simply stated, simplify it even more. It's simply making the effort to do the things which are helpful and avoid the things which are harmful. You know, that is not... Is that what the Buddha had to teach? You know, but it's a very basic idea. But again, if you're really present, you have your presence of what's here, paying attention, you'll notice consequences, you notice the impact you have, and I think you'll start noticing what is helpful and what is harmful. And the belief is you can discover that yourself. You don't need a book or a manual to tell you. But the more fully you are present, it's kind of the book is in you. Then right mindfulness. You know, the more present you are, mindfulness follows in the wake of presence. Relaxed presence, you'll be mindful. And then concentration as well arises out of strong presence. And because presence is something you inhabit, you find like your body, you're embodied. Concentration really has a lot to do with being embodied and settling and being absorbed, being fully present for our embodied experience. Mindfulness has a connotation or suggestion of being kind of more in the head, a little bit, for some people, of paying attention, noticing the kind of cognitive function of mindfulness. Concentration is very much the embodied quality, and the two work together. And an important part of practice is to bring those two together in harmony. So the cognitive functioning are really in harmony with the really being settled and fully connected here to your body. So these are the eight folds. And as we offer our presence, the folds unfold. And sooner or later, when the mind is completely opened up, it unfolds completely. And the creases are undone. And so then we have what's called right release. Sometimes translated as right liberation. But right liberation is, this connotation in Buddhism is that the experience of liberation involves a release, an unfolding, a setting free, a letting something, undoing a clinging or holding, a resistance that we have in our hearts. And so this release, the heart, the mind gets released. And then with that release comes right knowledge, right understanding, where you really understand what a released mind or heart is like, liberated mind and heart is like. And from the vantage point of some degree of release or freedom, you understand what it's like not to be free, what it's like to cling and to hold. And most people who have some experience of release don't get to keep it. And there's a few, maybe unusual spiritual adepts who just, you know, boom, one day, and it just, that was easy. And then it's that way forever. But for the huge majority of people, there might be some experience of freedom, some experience of release, and sometimes a small step, sometimes a big step. But then we grab on again. We close down again. And that they're seeing that distinction, that difference, is actually a very important part of practice. Some people suffer because of it. Once they have a sense of this peace, and they go back to feeling stressed, they go, oh no, they feel let down, disappointed. But actually, part of the practice is to have this right understanding, right knowledge, to see the difference. And then when you see the difference, then you really see the difference. Then you have a much better sense of what the practice is all about. And then you can start over again at the first step of the Eightfold Path. And you have so much more to go with. Because then your presence enters in more fully with that knowledge that you bring with you. So that's the Eightfold Path. It's a path of awareness and consequential relationships, thanks to Wendy. So now's your turn. And to ask questions or comments or something that seems relevant given the topic for today. And if you can use the mic, that would be helpful. I gave you a week warning. No week to think about it. And you make really good, they say in Buddhism, you make really good karma for yourself if you ask questions. So those of you who need karma, good karma. Oh, there's someone who needs karma. Yeah, but it's not for you, but people have hearing assistant devices. And so they can hear the question too.
Okay. I am less than a beginner. I am such a novice that just asking this question, you know, I feel right now that I'm amidst this room. I'm in a room full of masters. And I am the only beginner.
It seems to
that's
me
that's how much of a beginner I am.
Since you feel that way, you're going to even make even more good karma by asking a question. It's really good.
I hope so. So my very basic, fundamental, and beginner question, I think, has to do with there's Buddhism and there's psychology, and one can think about life and oneself, you know, in two paths. And I often wonder whether much of the goodness or kindness or giving that I do in the world and have done like since high school, I never thought about how much of it might have come from guilt. And, you know, so now Buddhism, and I'm expanding, and I'm, you know, asking questions. And now one of them is, oh, shoot. You know, what if this wonderful giving that I'm doing is coming from guilt? It's like, does that matter?
Great.
I guess that's my question.
Great.
Does that matter?
Great question. Thank you. And that, I think it's relevant for a lot of people, even the masters here.
Guilt, then is that guilt self-cherishing? Is that what she's saying? That guilt is a self-cherishing action?
I know. Is that what you said?
I don't know.
Neither do I.
This is our first time here.
Welcome. Welcome.
Perhaps I think the essential question may be, even if I am doing something, quote, good for someone else, out of a feeling of guilt or obligation, does that in any way lessen the value to the receiver or the giver?
That's a good question. There's a lot in your question. And I think that since you're new here, you'll find out quickly that I often don't give simple answers. It's this way and this way, and depends on this and that. And, you know, let's define our terms. And people seem to come back, so it's okay, I guess. They're still waiting for the answer. Waiting for years and years, I finally get to the answer, but. So guilt is something I'm very familiar with, the background of that. My own, you know, I operated under guilt a lot. I thought that gil was short for guilt. The value of, I think it's, there can be many, many motivations for giving and being kind, helpful in the world. And some of them, of course, can be incredibly greedy and self-serving. And then some of them can be tremendously altruistic. And some have a combination of both. And when they have the combination of both, I think it's a pity to throw out the good if there's some little bit might be bad, so, you know, or unskillful or something. You have to kind of look and see what's, you know, I've known people who really wanted to do something, had you know, 90% motivation to do something really beautiful in the world, but they held back because they felt 10% of it was selfish. And that was kind of a sad sacrifice. To sacrifice 90% good for 10%, you know, selfish is a bad exchange. Don't hold yourself hostage by a little bit of selfishness. But still, if a person had done it 100% without selfishness, the consequence for oneself and the other might have been even better. It was good with the 10% selfishness, but even better with the 100% without selfishness. And so you could look back at all the things you've done and look at the good and feel happy and delighted from that and benefit from that. But as a person develops greater presence, greater awareness of what's going on, chances are pretty good that if what you're calling guilt involves some kind of contraction, some kind of fear, some kind of sense of fearful obligation, some sense of some kind of suffering or stress in your system, you'll become aware of that. And hopefully, as you become aware of that, you'll realize and understand you don't have to live that way. And you can find other sources of motivation that you can do the same thing in the world, be kind and generous, that's not motivated by motivations that are stressful for you, that harm you in some way. And eventually the guilt will fall away. And in Buddhist English, in Buddhism, the word guilt, the concept of guilt, is considered unnecessary.
Too bad I was raised a Catholic.
I've known people who raised Catholic who had some difficulty with that. But I think there's also a lot of beauty in that religion, Catholicism. So rather than kind of feeling bad about it all, you can kind of recover what was beautiful and then find out what's not beautiful and let that go. And most people, mostly probably the guilt was not so necessary. That's my guess.
much in the 12 in the Eightfold Path implies an awareness of causes of suffering, craving, grasping, longing for. But we all have that, and there are normal or unnormal aspects of it. Could you perhaps amplify what the Buddhist sees as reasonable amounts of those things and and what's going to get us into trouble.
And what gives you trouble?
Well, the concept itself gives me trouble.
And maybe because of the Catholicism came up, it reminded me of, some reason it reminds me of, I guess it was St. Augustine who said, give me chastity but not yet. So it reminds me of that, you know, give me freedom from clinging, but not yet, not all of it. Some of it, you know, some of it still must be good, right? Isn't it normal? It is pretty normal. Does normal mean that it's, you know, we should live with it? And I think it, to answer your question, it's very important to distinguish between two different categories of desire. There's desire which comes along with clinging, craving, compulsion, obsession, addiction. And any kind of desire that comes with some quality of compulsion, drivenness, where you can't drop it, you can't let go of it easily, which is driving you, it comes with suffering, comes with angst, comes with stress, comes with despair, comes with a setup for grief and anxiety and a lot of things. There's a whole other category of desire, which that desire which does not come along with drivenness, compulsion, clinging, grasping, and all these things. And the message of the Buddha is that the first category you can uproot and be finished with once and for all. You don't have, even though it's normal for people to have that, it's not necessary to live that way. And with practice, with the practice, you can begin to lessen the force of clinging and compulsion, free yourself more and more from it, and then at some point become free. That leaves you with the other kind of desire. And because the other kind of desire has no compulsion to it, you're free in relationship to it. And you can, if it's a good, useful thing to do, you can do it. If it's not useful or not possible or whatever, you're not going to be troubled by it.
I'm thinking about the founding principles of our center. As I have heard you describe them, Gil, that we are all volunteers here, including you, that we are a dana-based, and that for you, right livelihood is an intimate partnership with the discretionary generosity of those of us who are attendees. I'm wondering where trust surfaces in the Eightfold Path, because it's not a specific named quality. So where does it surface? And I'm also curious to the degree that you're interested in elaborating for you how you have dealt with places in your practice, particularly in your livelihood practice, where trust has been a challenge. Okay. I see it a challenge for me sometimes.
Okay. Well. I'm very fond of the word trust, but words, when people use a single word, you know, it's very easy to miss each other because people have different definitions of the word. So I feel cautious. I mean, I could just jump in with my definition, assuming that's the same as yours. But I'm fond of the word trust, and I feel that one of the things that Buddhist practice has given me is a tremendous feeling of trust. And sometimes, in the many years ago, someone asked me, "Trust in what?" And I said, "No, I'm not trusting. There's no what. It's not like it's just trust. It's not, there's no trust in anything. Just a sense of trust." And there are three words which are close synonyms. There's trust, there's confidence, and there's faith. And the sense of faith, that sometimes the understanding of faith in the West, where faith is sometimes belief in a creed, that's kind of doesn't really, not so important in Buddhism. The sense of confidence is very important. And confidence is very important in the Eightfold Path. That you have to have some, enough confidence to want to engage in it. That you're able to, that you have the capacity to do it, that the practice is worthwhile to do, and that that the teachings, the teachers you have contact with, you have enough confidence in them to feel that you can be helped along, supported along the way. So in that confidence hopefully gets stronger over time, and developing of confidence and having strong confidence is very important, because sooner or later, I think in any spiritual discipline practice, a person's going to be challenged. If you don't get challenged, spiritual tradition is probably not worth much. So you do this practice, you can sooner or later you'd be challenged in some very deep way, and then you could decide you have confidence in some other religion instead at that moment, and switch. And some people like to switch whenever it gets challenging. But it's a whole other thing to keep your confidence, even though it's difficult here, I have enough confidence to work with this difficulty. So confidence is an indispensable part of it. Trust, I think, is a little bit closer to faith, in the sense that we have faith or trust in something that is different than ourselves, or we have trust in something unseen, unknown, something going on. So, for example, for me, there are situations I find myself in where social situations, difficult situations, socially, interpersonally maybe, or sometimes people come and talk to me about their difficulties or something, and I don't really know what they should do. I don't know what's supposed to happen. I don't know what's supposed to go on now and how to solve this problem. But I have a lot of trust in the power of being present and being mindful of the situation and staying present and engaged in it. And with mindfulness and presence in the situation, then something seems to unfold that seems beneficial, or the situation seems to find its way if there's mindfulness there, there's presence there, commitment being honest and staying present. And so I have trust in that process that unfolds when I'm present. But in saying that, I don't have trust. I don't know what it's going to be. There's an unknown quality to it. So confidence has something known, in a sense. Trust has something unknown. And so to give you an analogy, that maybe it's an unfortunate analogy, but meaningful for some people at the right time. Maybe it's not the right time for some of you. Some of you will go screaming away. That sooner or later in practice, it can feel like you come to an edge of a cliff. And the instruction is to step off the edge. Now, that seems like you look down over the abyss. It's really far down. And it's not a reasonable thing to do, to step over that abyss. Because, we've been told not to play around with gravity that way. And so, but you're told, yes, but you have to do. So it takes a long time. Finally, the person said, okay. So you take that step out into the Grand Canyon. And then as you do that, the cliff grows out and receives the step. But then you're told to take the next step. That's almost as bad as the first time, but then you take the step and the cliff grows out and receives the step. So life's like that. So it takes a lot of trust, because each moment we're stepping into the unknown. So that willingness to kind of be present and let the next moment unfold, and it isn't completely, we do it without any support. The Eightfold Path is a tremendous support: mindfulness, ethics, right, good behavior, our understanding, our knowledge, our practice, all help and support that. So we don't go unassisted. But there is a sense that we kind of, sooner or later, a person in practice has to be willing to let go, in a sense, of everything you know, of everything of who you think you are, and everything what you think about who other people are and what's supposed to be going on. And that complete letting go, and then into the unknown. It takes a lot of trust. So that was part of your question, I think. It was a big question. And then part of it was livelihood, trusting livelihood. Or is that enough for now?
Hi, I'm Lauren. I want to know, I have a sense of where I am in terms of my practice, and at this point, I believe this is not my last lifetime.
Okay.
You know, we'll see what the next 30, 40 years has to offer in my practice. And I think that I get a sense of some people who are further, I'm going to say further, on the path. And I want to know if to, would you know when you reach the point where you're not coming back again? And maybe you're choosing to, you know, to live a life of a bodhisattva, and you have come back again, you personally, Gil. So do I need to live the Eightfold Path perfectly at all times to get to that place? And I also have chosen to, if I get to that place, to return again.
You've chosen that.
I have chosen to be a bodhisattva.
Okay.
But I don't think that this is my last lifetime.
Okay.
So it's that's kind of a moot point, because I think that I'm not quite in the place of my practice where I've learned enough of the lessons to not have to come back again.
Great.
But I don't know. Maybe I'll work it out in the still in this lifetime. I think I still have some time.
Okay.
So I was wondering if you could comment on that.
It's a great question. Great concern. Great topic that you're bringing up. You're also bringing up something that I don't know much about. I don't really know. I mean, I can give you textbook answers, Buddhist textbook answers to how rebirth does and doesn't happen and all that. But when I don't come back, I can't come back and tell you how it works.
But you might have chosen to have come back.
I might have, yeah. So I don't know. You're talking about things I don't know about. I practiced in Buddhist traditions where the idea of multiple lives and rebirths was not really part of the discussion. So there wasn't a big concern. So I had 30 years of more Buddhist practice without that being kind of important part of the discussion. So I haven't given much thought, myself, about should I come back? Do I want to come back? Sometimes I joke that with my karma, I'll come back as a Unitarian minister. but I don't know. But your question is serious, and I don't want to. A couple of things I could say is that you use the word perfect. The definition of perfection in the Buddhist spiritual practice, there is an idea of perfection, and the idea of perfection is that which gets you off the wheel, that you don't no longer come back. So you need to get, So you don't get partially pregnant, right? You people get pregnant, they're perfectly pregnant. So you have to be perfectly off the wheel. And what it said is that someone who has done that work, that they're not going to get reborn, they rather than practicing the Eightfold Path, they become the Eightfold Path. It becomes who they are. So it becomes, it's not something they practice or think about or do, or just kind of innate. It comes kind of what comes, how they live their life is that way. So part of one of the things we're doing with the Eightfold Path is we're kind of developing, it develops within us until, you know, it develops such a degree that in a sense we become the Eightfold Path. That, you know, we can understand our life, that this is just kind of, you see that person, you see, well, that person obviously, you know, they lives naturally, easily, effortlessly, those eight qualities, or ten qualities, tenfold path. And then the mechanism of which all this works, there's different theories in Buddhism about, well, one very common theory is that if you get fully liberated, you will not come back, even if you're hoping to come back as a bodhisattva. And so the bodhisattva is someone who goes right up at the right to highly developed bodhisattva is someone who goes right up to the brink of awakening, full awakening, and then has a skill to hold back. And some people believe, in different Buddhist traditions there are different lore, different kind of understandings, and over history there's been different understandings of how this, the connection between rebirth and enlightenment, and what the, and the bodhisattva. And there's no, you know, so you get, depending on the tradition you practice in, you get different understandings for it all. And I've known people who have done, you know, serious vipassana practice, and at some point in their practice, they got a sense, very strong sense, that they had somehow in the past made very strong bodhisattva vows. And so that was now going to change the way they were going to practice because of these past vows that they made. You know, so then they changed how they practiced. So it's a whole topic. So, but you know, I'm talking about what I don't know. So I respect the question, but. So last one, yes.
I did Jungian analysis for a number of years and got into dream recording my dreams and dreams analysis and really sort of. Into that quite a bit. And then when I began more serious Buddhist meditation and study, I began to have second thoughts about that, about the analytical process and whether or not that was really skillful and useful, in the sense that if our thoughts are like clouds, you know, passing the sky, why waste my time on a deep analysis of the unconscious? And do you have any thoughts or opinions on that?
I don't know enough about Jungian analysis to have an informed opinion about it. I think my basic stance about it is that I have a lot of respect for it. I think that there's certainly something there. And I know people who, good friends of mine who I respect, who are Buddhist teachers, have found a lot of value from Jungian analysis. Some of them became Jungian analysts themselves. So, I haven't done a study, you know, to know what's all going on there. I do know that the human mind is amazingly creative in kind of subconscious, unconscious ways, and it's not always so easy to get in touch with that and contact that, and that there's a variety of ways to get in touch with it. One way perhaps is through dreams. Dreams are interesting. And in a sense, Buddhist practice is trying to get down to the subconscious as well. But generally, there are Buddhist practices that involve dream work, but I haven't done any of that. The work of deep meditation, deep concentration, deep stillness, deep mindfulness, touches on some of the deeper subconscious places in the mind, things we normally don't see in everyday life. Start seeing more and more subtlety, and I don't know if the idea of unconscious is a strong Buddhist idea, because I think but subconscious is, because subconscious meaning you can in theory become aware of it if you have enough concentration, enough stillness. The idea of unconscious is completely out of you know, you can't touch it at all. It's not a strong Buddhist idea. And so then there's other avenues for making that contact to the depths of us. And one of the ways that I think it's very, very powerful is mindfulness of the body. And it seems the body is about as far away from the dreams as you can think of, but the body is so integrated with our psychology. And so much so that my claim is that the body is the royal road to the unconscious, to requote, I guess, Jung or Freud. But it's a very different, it's a different route, and you don't have, it's not as, you know, fascinating in the same way that perhaps, you know, symbols can be. And then the final thing I want to say is that the way we work with dreams in Vipassana meditation, like when people come on retreat and they start having dreams, they ask, I have these fascinating dreams, you know, they're full of symbolism and all this stuff, what does it mean? And we won't get in that context, we won't get into the meaning generally, occasionally. It might seems interesting, but generally we won't, as teachers, we won't touch it. But what we do is encourage them to practice mindfulness with the experience of dreaming this way. When they wake up from the dream, and it's a strong dream, sit up in your bed and meditate, close your eyes, and meditate on the felt sense, the feeling tone, the feeling, the emotional quality that's lingering from that dream. Put aside the content of the dream, and then the emotions that are connected to the dream, that's the door to go in deep and find out what's going on in some useful way from our point of view, and process something. So hopefully that's an adequate answer. Okay, well, I thought it was great. I really enjoyed all your questions. I valued them, and I thought it was nice that we took that time. We should probably do that more often.